We're continuing part two, Parshas Vayishlach. We had seen Yaakov sent messengers to his brother Esav. Yaakov sent flocks of sheep, gifts to his brother Esav. Yaakov finally tried to run away from his brother Esav, was stopped by a malach, fought the malach. The malach didn't win him. He seems to have won the malach, but the malach wounds him, and now Yaakov met up with him, with Esav, after overtaking his malach, and Esav kisses him. We saw different interpretations, whether Esav meant to bite him, Esav wanted to kill him, whether Esav really loved him. They both cry, and then Esav departs, and Yaakov comes to the city of Shechem. He's come back to the land of Israel. He has a vow outstanding. He has promised God that he will take off a tenth and donate it. He will establish a place of worship, and he does not take care of this vow. And now he's back in the land of Israel, and he camps facing the city. He paves the city roads, or he institutes bathhouses. He implements a coin. He does something to benefit society. And he establishes a place of recognition, an academy where people can learn about the ways of Hashem. And his daughter goes out to find some girls to play with, and she gets abducted by Shechem, the prince, the son of Hamor, the king, and he takes her forcibly and lives with her forcibly and decides that he loves her and tries to convince her to stay with him. And then he sends his father, and then he also joins the conversation, trying to bargain with the brothers to let him keep their sister, to let him keep Dina. Now, we see over here, they don't bring Dina back. This whole conversation is taking place when Dina is still in their palace. It's their home territory, and they're coming and saying, "What do you guys want? We'll make you whatever deal you want. Give us the girl." She's by them. But they're scared. They don't want Yaakov to attack. So they say, "Let's make a deal." And Yaakov's sons, Shimon and Levi, they are burning mad. Their anger is flaring. How could such a thing be done? The whole world doesn't behave like this. Certainly among the people of Israel, we're so pure. We treat ourselves. We value the relationship between a husband and wife so much. We don't even think of such a thing. How could he do such a thing among us? Among them, it's unacceptable. Certainly among us. And they're burning mad, and they answer with cunning. They tell Hamor, they say, "You know, it's a disgrace for us to marry, to be part with people who have a foreskin. You guys have to circumcise, and then we'll make a pact with you." And what Shimon and Levi are saying is, if you guys become like us, so that you don't look down at us and say, "Oh, they're the ones with the foreskin," you accept it as a national thing, everyone's the same, so then we could unite. And Shechem and Hamor convince their people of that. Now, we have mass circumcision going on in the city. It takes 3 days. 3 days, everyone's being circumcised. And by the third day, when they're all done, everyone's lying in bed, wallowing in pain. And Shimon and Levi start to go around the city. According to one understanding, they were saying, "We'll bring you painkillers, guys. We'll make it easier on you." And then they told the families, "Guys, you guys have to be really quiet now, because we gave them some painkillers. They're going to be out for a little bit." So they kill all the men who are circumcised, and the whole city of Shechem has been wiped out. All men are killed. Only women and children are left. And then the rest of the family comes and they take everything in the city. So Yaakov hears this, and he tells them, "You guys are endangering all of us. Till now, the nations knew we wouldn't conquer the land of Israel, but they knew it wasn't now. Now that you're doing this, all the nations are going to think we're a threat to them. And there could be a unification of all the neighboring cities to come and attack us. What can I do?" Shimon and Levi, when they entered the city, what were they thinking? They were thinking, "We have a father, he's strong, he could handle whatever happens." And Yaakov said to himself, he said, "What, just because my kids did something stupid, I'm going to let them fall in the hands of the nations?" Yaakov took his bow and arrow, he took his sword, and he stood at the entrance to the city, and he said, "Anyone who wants to take on my kids has to take me on first." And he saved them. And in his doing that, really, the city of Shechem became Jewish territory. because he ensured that the nations wouldn't attack. God made a miracle that the nations were scared to attack. I mean, think about it. All he's got is 70 people. So they're 70 mighty warriors, but still, you'd think that the surrounding nations could attack. So God made a miracle, and the people did not attack. But ultimately, Yaakov feels like this is his land. Meaning Yaakov, at the end of his days, is going to give this land of Shechem as a gift to his son Yosef. And the burning question is, what right does Yaakov have to that land? Shimon and Levi took that land. And the answer is that Shimon and Levi, it's true, they killed all the men. But they couldn't have held on to the land. They did it assuming that Yaakov would stand up for them, and Yaakov did. So bottom line, it was Yaakov who owned the territory. And that's why Yaakov gives it as a gift to Yosef. Now, what were Shimon and Levi thinking, and what was Yaakov thinking? Because Yaakov was present when this deal was being made. Yaakov heard them telling the people of Shechem, you guys circumcise and we'll make a deal. And then afterwards he gets upset. So what was he thinking during those 3 days when they were all getting circumcised? Yaakov thought that they'd walk into the palace, everyone's writhing in pain, they could walk into the palace and take Dina back and then they'd leave. If they have to, they'll kill the king, Hamor and Shechem. They're the abductors. The Hamor is really taking sides with Shechem. But he didn't think they'd kill the whole city out. Now, the city did deserve to be killed, because the halacha is that non-Jews don't have many mitzvahs. But the mitzvahs that they have to keep themselves and enforce in their cities. And here you had a city where the prince abducted a girl. So rape is not one of the Sheva Mitzvos Bnei Noach. It's not incest. But it is one of the Sheva Mitzvos Bnei Noach in that it is thievery. You're damaging someone. You're taking someone against their consent. So what Shechem did, in essence, was a form of thievery. And one of the obligations of the people of Shechem at that point was to establish a court, try him, find him guilty, and administer the death penalty. That was their obligation. In not doing that, the people of Shechem themselves were Chayev Misa. The people of Shechem were idol worshippers. They're Chayev Misa for that. So the people of Shechem deserved to be killed. But Yaakov felt like, it's true, they deserve the death penalty. Why do we have to take care of it? It's a problem. They do deserve the death penalty. They have to take care of that. They have to take care of Shechem, they have to take care of Hamor, they have to take care of the city, they have to take care of those that are worshipping idols. But that's not our job. And Shimon and Levi said, legally we're entitled to do it. We're going to risk our lives, we're going to go in there and save Dina. And their anger, to an extent, got the better of them. And that's why when Yaakov, at the end of his days, gives a message to each child, he tells Shimon and Levi, Shimon v'Levi Achim, they're brothers, they work in cahoots. Klei chamas mecherotehim, but their weapons are stolen goods. They shouldn't be using these weapons. That's not the way a Jew should be behaving. Esav deals with the sword. They shouldn't have taken the sword to settle the deal.
So he curses their anger.
Arur apam. Then he curses their anger, right. He says they shouldn't have let their anger get the better of them. Here we see that there was an aspect where their anger got the better of them. At the time he did say something. He told them, "Achartem oti." He told them, "You've endangered my life."
They were upset, not that they killed everybody, but that it endangered the family. But when he says death, that that's when he curses their
right.
actions for
right.
Killing
the people of Shechem. Yeah. Yeah.
Just like adults, but this shows that it didn't. But
not so much that you think just like a 40-year-old, but that you're now able, you're willing to do things for other people more, and that's the real thing of a bar mitzvah.
You fit? Okay.
But, I don't know. Have you heard
what you're referring to.
Yeah.
I don't know.
That
they were 13. Yeah, yes, but that this was
the same age. Mm-hmm.
They weren't the same age.
Maybe.
I mean, they could have. There was 7th month apart between them. So Shimon and Levi, the pasuk says they were Yaakov's children, but they didn't behave like his children because they didn't take counsel with him. They went ahead and acted on their own. They were adults, but they acted on their own. And a child, when he does such an important decision, he's living with his father, it's going to affect his father, and even if not, he should take counsel with his parent. And this is something to know. Out of their hearts to your parents, it's right to take counsel with them. I always tell guys, you remember, we said that this week, you're starting to date, one of the first things is tell your parents. They're entitled to have a part in it. They brought you up, they invested in you. You guys, God willing, we'll have kids of your own, and you'll see. It's definitely hard work, but you owe it to them. That's part of life. You owe it to them to share your important decisions with them. I tell people sometimes, you know what your decision is, right? So call your parents, take counsel with them, and present them with the reason why you think it should be done, and they'll agree with you, and they'll feel good that you took counsel with them. And you know what? You'll gain from taking counsel with them. They do have life experience. If you're certain that this is the right decision, so at least give them the feeling that they have a hand in it, that they have a role in it. So we have war, and Dina is brought back, and it is unclear what happened with her ultimately. Did Shimon marry her? What happened exactly? Did she remain widowed for the rest of her life? And God tells Yaakov, go pay up your vow. And when Yaakov is en route, so Rachel passes away. And here we're going to deal with what Ari brought up last night, that our sages say that when one delays bringing one's vow, so God takes collateral from a person. And that collateral could be in the form of one's children, God forbid, or one's wife. So the first thing we should mention is that the conclusion of the Gemara is not that way. This is the Gemara brings this thought, and the Gemara says not that way. The Gemara says I don't remember. It's a Gemara in Rosh Hashanah. In a few days they'll get in Daf Yomi. That he will get punished and his wife won't get punished. So we have to know that in the Bavli, it seems to go not that way. What's interesting is that in many Midrashim, it does take that route. In the Midrashim we find in all over that this concept is brought out. That if one detains bringing one's vow, then one's wife is in danger, one's children are in danger, and then ultimately oneself. And we have to address that. So when a child is very, very young, so then really, what does he know? If he dies a painless death, his parents are the ones that suffer. But as a person grows up, he's got a job in this world. He wants to fulfill that job. He doesn't want to die. So how could a wife die for her husband's sins? It's interesting, as we enter this discussion, that there are sources that say that when a child is bar mitzvah, he should bang on the bima and say, Baruch Sheptarani Monshosh Shazeh. Thank God I'm no longer going to get punished for what he does wrong. Because until now, until he's bar mitzvah, he's collateral. So we're going to address it a little bit. It deserves more, but we'll at least open it up. Chazal tell us that there are three things that a person can do that will cause his book up in heaven to be opened. Meaning that he'll be judged in heaven. A person, it seems, can sometimes be standing just balanced. And any little thing could tilt him off balance. if a person has many, many merits, so then you need a lot to get him to fall or to get him to deserve to die. But sometimes a person is at a stage where he could make it, he could not. And then God says, so long as you lead a safe life, so you'll live. If you endanger yourself and you need me to intervene, so then I'm not going to intervene on your behalf. You're not good enough for that. For example, if one wears tzitzit, we say that tzitzit is not obligatory. But if one enters a situation of danger, then God says, I'll go the extra mile for him. That doesn't mean people won't die. We know people die wearing tzitzit, right? People do die in car accidents when they're wearing tzitzit and all kinds of other things, God forbid. But at the end of the day, the mitzvah tzitzit is one of those mitzvot where God says, I'll go the extra mile. The Mishnah says, if women aren't careful, and there are three mitzvot, Rashi Tevot Chana, Chala, Nida, Hadlakat Aner, taking off challah, taking off the little bit that we burn nowadays as truma from the dough that we make, and Nida, the laws of family purity, and lighting the candles, the Shabbos candles. So if a woman isn't careful on that, then she could die, God forbid, when she is in labor. So the Gemara automatically asks, and what about men? So the Gemara says, yeah, men, well, they could die when they're crossing a bridge or all kinds of other situations of danger. The concept is very simply that when a person enters a situation of danger and then he needs God to help him out, so then God says, if you lived up to your end of the deal, then I'll go the extra mile for you. And when Chazal tell us that my husband's doing this, then his wife is part of the collateral, what that means is that, let's say the wife was balanced, and she really could go this way or that way. So God says, I won't interfere. And then she enters labor. And in labor, especially in ancient times, a woman's in danger. Many women died during labor. Labor today, thank God, has become a much easier process. Not that it's easy, but that at least we have far under 1% women died during labor. And once upon a time, it was far above 5%. Many women died in labor. So when a woman enters this situation of danger and she needs God to go the extra mile, so God says, does she deserve it? She's balanced. She doesn't really deserve it. And if her husband did this, if her husband had a vow that's outstanding and he didn't do it, so God says, that's one of the things that'll hold me back from going the extra mile. Whatever our sages tell us, that if you do something, then something else will ensue. A person says Ashrei three times a day, the Gemara says, he'll merit to have the world to come. Oh, great. So all I have to do is say Ashrei three times a day. I could rob banks, I could murder, I could plunder, I can do whatever I want. I say Ashrei three times a day. So it's obviously not that way. What the Gemara means is that this has a certain weight with regard to this aspect. With regard to Olam Haba, saying Ashrei three times a day has a special weight. That's like you ask a doctor, you say that if people smoke, then they die young. Well, I know so-and-so, he smoked and he died till age of 92. So the doctor is going to tell you, yeah, there are many factors, and this is going to contribute to certain factors that will cause many people to die young, but it's not 100%. Same thing is true in Chazal tell us that if a person has an outstanding debt of a vow to God, he took a vow he'll do something, and he doesn't, so then it doesn't mean his wife will die on the spot, but it does mean that it will contribute to that. Dina, according to one understanding I recorded last night, Dina was abducted in part because when Yaakov was coming to meet Esav, Yaakov said, I don't want Esav to get a look at her, he might want to marry her, and then how could I refuse? And why should she marry such a Rasha? So he put her in a box, and that's why she's not mentioned in the whole encounter with Esav. She doesn't appear in the Psukim. And there's a Medrash that says that God said, you held back Dina from being a potential wife for Esav. Maybe she would have had him do tshuva. You didn't want him to take her, look what's going to end up. So she ends up being taken by someone that's worse, someone that's Shechem, against her will.
Esav?
What?
Worse than Esav?
That's what the Medrash seems to say. I don't know, it doesn't seem like he's worse than Esav, you're right. The Medrash stresses that he was an Orel. that Esav was circumcised and Shechem was not even circumcised. So we quoted a medrash that says that Esav was not circumcised, but there are medrashim that say that Esav was and his offsprings were not. That Esav's children stopped circumcising themselves, but Esav himself was. There are different medrashim. Remind me on a Thursday night, we'll deal with it. Sure, we have a class on that on the web. It's also on the disc. What do we do when we have conflicting midrashim? And if you remind me later on, we can get back to that. What do we do with conflicting midrashim? But I think everyone here heard it because we dealt with it like 2 weeks ago or 4 weeks ago. It's very current. It's very fresh. I think so. So how do we understand this medrash? So firstly, we don't have to understand every medrash. Sometimes you could read a medrash and say, I don't understand that. I really don't get what that means. How could that be? And tell yourself, gee, I have a very strong question. This doesn't work. And then you might not sleep at night. You might be upset. You might bug your rabbi with it, and he might not understand it. And he might give you an answer, and you might not be happy with that answer. And all that means is that sometime later in your life, hopefully you'll find the answer, and maybe not. I encountered a medrash once that bothered me for years. And then, after many, many years, I encountered someone who actually dealt with all the problems that bothered me about that medrash. The medrash about Moshe agreeing to give one of his child up to Avodah Zarah. We discussed it once in our class. What does that medrash mean? So now you're all wondering. When we get to that parasha, if you want, we'll discuss it. First thing you guys have to know is that, so you have a question. Just because you don't have an answer does not invalidate the question. It could be a valid question, and we don't have an answer. And just because you have a question does not invalidate the medrash. So there's a medrash which we don't understand. So we could leave it at that. And I'm tempted to do that just to get you accustomed to it. But I won't do that. There's a classic explanation that's given by the Bali Musar. And they say that Yaakov could have put her in a box the way he did. He could have. He's entitled to do that. But as he was knocking the nails in, he was feeling too good about it. Good. She's not going to be for Esau. And that little bit of feeling good about the fact that he's holding his daughter back from Esau, that little bit, the Bali Musar say, God says, I'm taking you for task even on that. So that's one thing. Again, we have to apply to that understanding everything we said a minute ago. Well, what did Dina do wrong? So we'll have to say that there was something Dina did wrong, which our sages expand on. And Dina did do something deserving to have this happen to her. But that goes into a whole question of can one's bechira affect someone else's bechira, which we can't deal with tonight. Meaning, if I smack you, I could say you must have deserved it, otherwise God wouldn't let me smack you, right? How does that work? When my bechira touches onto your bechira, can I always say that if it happened, then obviously God wants it? So that's something to be dealt with, but not now. But that's really the question. What about Dina here? What did she do wrong? There are other understandings here as to why Dina was taken. And one of the Mepharshim that deal with this says, wait a second, Leah spent all of her childhood crying not to marry Esau. So if that's so right, then what about Dina? It seems that women can alter men. The Gemara quotes that there were a couple, he was a tzaddik, she was a tzaddikess, and he married a woman who was a rasha, and she married a man who was a rasha, and after many years, she got her husband to be a tzaddik like her, and after many years, he was a rasha like his wife. Seems like as strong as us men are, at the end of the day, the woman's pulling the strings. And it seems like Dina was really, really good at getting people to become better. And if Dina would have married Esav, then there was a probability that was so high that it would have worked that Yaakov shouldn't have said no. So, according to that understanding, Yaakov, understandably didn't want to be put in this situation where he has to give his daughter to Esau. But on the other hand, the question is, should Yaakov have interfered and not let Dina see Esau altogether? And to an extent, I think, this is my own understanding, the Medrash is telling us a little bit what goes on in life. Sometimes we think, I'll avoid this shidduch and I'll get something better. And we end up with something much worse. So in life, we have to strive for what's best, but we also have to be practical. People sometimes say, she has too long a nose, I don't like her smile, this girl I don't like her accent, this girl I don't like her father, this girl I don't like her aunt. People have all kinds of excuses why they don't get engaged. And sometimes in life, if you don't take what's good, then you end up with what's worse. And you don't have a choice at the end. And this is true in many aspects. So maybe that's what the Medrash is coming to stress. But there are other explanations. If you want, look at the Mefarshim. Everyone's bothered by the question, and there are many answers given. These are three possible answers, but there are more. Let's think about Yaakov's life a little bit and Rachel's life a little bit. Rachel had a beautiful childhood. She grew up 23 years thinking she's going to marry the tzaddik of the world, be a mother of the shvatim in the world. Rachel was beautiful. Rachel was admired. Rachel knew what her job in this world would be. And then one fateful night, Rachel's life took a turn for the worse. On that night, she was supposed to begin her journey being Yaakov's wife. And on that night, her father intervened and said, Leah, you go in. And Rachel, being the tzaddikas that she was, she turned to Leah and said, Leah, I don't want you to get embarrassed. I'm going to tell you the secret sign I'm supposed to give Yaakov so that you could fool him into thinking you are I. And this way you won't be embarrassed over there under the chuppah when Yaakov says, hey, wait a second, this isn't Rachel. And so Rachel gives Leah, her twin sister, those signs. And from that minute on, we would expect that Rachel would have a beautiful life again. Because Rachel just did the greatest mitzvah that she could. She protected her sister from being embarrassed. We would think that what would Rachel get as a reward for that? She'd get to be Yaakov's beloved wife with many children. She'd get the treatment she'd want. Everything would be beautiful for Rachel. And what happens? She becomes the second wife. And Yaakov is stuck working another 7 years for her father without an income. And she can't have children. And her sister does have children. And when she even asks her sister for a little bit of the flowers that her child brings her that might help her conceive, what does her sister tell her? Bad enough you took my husband, now you want to take my flowers? What kind of life is Rachel leading? She turns to her husband and says, you didn't give me children. And her husband says, what can I do? Am I God? And so she says, okay, take my maid and maybe God will see how much I want to bring children into the world. So now Yaakov has another wife in the picture, and then he ends up having another wife in the picture, and she still doesn't have children. Everyone can have children but her. Her sister Leah was in the same predicament. Physically they were created the same. They were twins. Leah wasn't physically able to have children, and yet God does a miracle for Leah. Leah has kids. But Rachel, she doesn't get this miracle. So Rachel is spending her life at the back of the bandwagon, the one without kids, and the one who gave up the ability to be the sole wife of Yaakov. Things aren't looking so pretty, yeah.
Rachel and Leah are like born at the same time, twins, they look the same and everything?
I don't know. All it says is that they were twins. We can infer that they look the same from the fact that they were able to fool Yaakov. But what it says in Seder Olam Rabba, in the Midrash, is that they were twin sisters.
Avraham Yitzchak Yaakov was accompanied by Sarah, Rivka, and Racha. But Leah, we said all this stuff about like kind of first and kids first. So why is the last name Rachel?
Leah is also. Rachel comes before Leah. Remind me, later we'll deal with that. So, where is Rachel's life going? Finally, she has one child. Everyone else already has two. And what's Rachel's request? She calls him Yosef. She says, God, add me, give me another one. Yosef Hashem li ben acher. I want one more. Doesn't work. She's running away from her father's house. She finally comes to the land of Israel, and she conceives. And now they're traveling, and she's about to give birth. and the delivery isn't going well. And she's lying there, she's been married to Yaakov now 7 or 8 years, and she's, no, I'm sorry, 14 or 15 years. They got married at 23. He worked for her father another 7 years, and then another 6 years, that's 13 years, and then another year and a half passed by. So we're holding by 14 and a half years. She is the ripe old age of approximately 37, 36, 37, and her delivery isn't going well. And she is going to die. And her life, from the minute she did this act of piety, took a turn for the worse. From the minute she let her sister walk in first, her life became difficult, and very difficult. And now she ends this death where she leaves her husband to her sister. One of the messages we have to learn from Tanakh is that the concept of living happily ever after does not exist. We should never expect it. If you're a pious person, then God wants you to grow in this world. And growth comes from dealing with hardships. There's nothing wrong with hardships. It's part of growth. It's difficult, it's hard, but it's growth. The Medrash says that many people had hardships in this world. Eov, Job had hardships. He yelled, he called, cried out, the whole book of Job. He's crying, God, what's going on here? Why am I suffering? Avram, Abraham had hardships, he was silent. He said, God told him, take that son and bring him up. 3 days he's traveling and he's thinking, God, just before you told me he's going to have so many nations, and now you're telling me to offer him, what's going on here? Doesn't say a word, he's silent. Avram's level is he's silent. And David got tested, and David sang. He said, God, give me more. This is my growth. This is what I want in this world. I'm here to grow. Test me. So Rachel has had a very difficult life, and she ends up dying over here at childbirth. And we have to know that when we do a good act, it does not mean we will not pay the price. Sometimes we think, if I did what's right, then things should look good afterwards. Doesn't work that way. A person can do what's right, pay the price, and spend his whole life paying the price, but he still did what's right. Just because a person is paying the price does not mean that he didn't do what's right. Rachel spends her whole life paying the price for letting Leah go in first. But many years later, hundreds of years later, when the Jewish people are being exiled, they're going to pass by her grave. And up in heaven, they're very upset at the Jewish people. The Jewish people have sinned so much that God has to destroy the temple and exile the Jewish people. And Avram walks into the heavens and says, God, forgive them, they're my sons. And God says, yeah, look at how they're behaving. And Yitzchak walks in and God says, look at how they're behaving. And Yaakov walks in and God says, look at how they're behaving. And Moshe walks in and God says, what do you want from me? They're not keeping the Torah you gave them. And Yoshua walks in. Every leader the Jewish people had tries to enter the heavenly gates and plead for the Jewish people, and God doesn't accept what they say. And the Torah itself walks in and God says, what do you want? They're not keeping you. And then they pass by Rachel's grave. And they stand by Rachel's grave, cave of Rachel, and they start crying. And the Navi tells us that at that moment, Rachel was aroused from her grave, and she walked in before Hashem. And she said, Hashem, I let my tzara, my competition, the one who would spend her whole life being my competition for my husband, I brought her into the house. And I lived with that all the years that I was married to Yaakov. If I could live with that, you could live with the fact that your children are serving idols. So they brought in an idol into the Beis HaMikdash. So they served the idol, and they bowed down to the sun, and they pulled down their pants towards the Holy of Holies. They did that. But if I could live with another wife in the same house, you could live with their idol worship in your house. And when Rachel said that, God didn't have an answer. She wasn't saying they're righteous. She wasn't saying save them because they're my kids. She was saying, I could do it. I lived with it. I did what was right. For doing what was right, they're your children. This is what I want from you. And God said, her voice penetrated. For her claim, God did forgive the Jewish people. Her voice is the one that made it through. So her whole life, she didn't see the fruits. Her whole life was miserable. Rachel lives a life that's basically miserable. And she ends dying a very unpleasant death, dying during childbirth. But the reward, the fruits of what she did, is going to come to play many, many years later. So Yaakov is left without his wife. And at this point, the Torah records the death of Rivka's wet nurse. And it's unclear why is this important. So our sages say that what happened was... Yeah?
Well, it makes no sense. You need a good life. You're going to suffer.
So that I'll be happy to deal with afterwards. No, remind me. The tradition we have is that at this point, Rivka passed away. And when Rivka passed away, Yitzhak was blind at home. He couldn't deal with her. Yaakov was out with his family. He was a distant, he hadn't yet come. Esav didn't really like Rivka. He wasn't too happy with her. And Yitzhak said, I don't want to wait for Esav to come and I'll ask him to bury her, because then everyone's going to say, what a cursed woman that her son is Esav. So Yitzhak said, we'll do it quietly at night. He told the servants, take her body, take her into the Maris HaMachpelah, bury her over there. And that's how Rivka was buried, quietly, without any great procession, because by this time Esav was so well known as the Rasha that he was, that Yitzhak said it's more honor for her to make a quiet burial than to make it publicized. And the Torah also hides Rivka's passing to allude to that. The Torah doesn't mention her passing. The Torah mentions that her wet nurse passed, and at that point Yaakov named the place the tree of multiple cryings. And our sages say, what were the multiple cryings? Because at the same time, Rivka passed away. They both passed away at the same time, and this is the allusion to it. Yeah?
What was he buried in the Maris HaMachpelah? Such a holy place.
Who, Rivka? Because she was a very holy person. So wait, we'll get to that. When we get to Esau, we'll deal with Esau. Jumping ahead.
It's not really a lot of it, it's just a thing.
After Rachel passes away, so Yaakov takes his bed and he puts it by her maid. His main place of rest is going to be by her maid. And Reuben sees this and he says, throughout my mother's life, she had to deal with Rachel as the competition. Now Rachel passed away. Why does my mother have to deal with this competition of the maid? That now the maid is getting that she's the main wife. So Reuven, trying to fight for his mother's honor, takes his father's bed and he moves it into Leah's tent. And when Yaakov sees this, he gets very upset. At the end of his life, Yaakov is going to tell Reuven, "Pachas kamayim al total, you were swift like water. Water rushes. And you erred. You erred in the fact that you interfered about where my bed goes." Why did Yaakov do it though? Why did Yaakov move his bed to Bilhah's tent? So one understanding says that this was a way of showing honor to Rachel. That as though this is the continuation of Rachel, he's showing honor to Rachel. It was at Leah's expense. So it's a good question. Obviously, for some reason, it was more important to show that honor to Rachel. And we might have an inkling of an understanding to that when we deal with what you brought up, that when we speak about the Imos, we say, Sara Rivka Rachel Leah. Rachel always precedes Leah. And this was instituted by the tribe of Judah. Yehuda instituted this, his tribe, in the story of Rus. When they blessed Boaz, they said, God should make your house like the house of Rachel and Leah. And they gave Rachel the honor of being mentioned first, even though she was the second wife. Meaning the tribe of Yehuda, who come from Leah, they themselves, who represent aristocracy, they acknowledge that the main wife, the main, as far as Imos goes, is Rachel. And maybe, I didn't see anyone that says this, but maybe that's part of the message that Yaakov is giving by moving his bed to Bilhah. By moving it to Bilhah, he's saying there's an element here where Rachel, and even her maid, is a way of showing honor to Rachel, that she comes first, even though she was the second wife. In Kabbalah it says that Rachel didn't have to be buried with Yaakov because they were soulmates. In heavens they were together without being buried together. Leah, who was a balancing factor to Yaakov, who wasn't, whatever it means, his soulmate, she had to be buried with him in order for them to be together in heavens. So what does that mean? I don't know, but that's what it says. You guys might know. I'm telling you what it says. Fine. So,
I remember reading that it said that they couldn't bury Rachel in Machpelah because there have been two wives buried in Machpelah and it's forbidden in the Torah, that more than one wife, so they couldn't.
Well,
you mean two sisters. Two sisters. There is that understanding that says he couldn't bury two sisters together. But then Rachel should have first dibs. She died first. So the simple understanding is, we say when a woman passes away, we rush her burial. Because when a person passes away, his bodily fluids start to come out. And as much as we try to clean out the bodily fluids and then stuff up the holes, at the end of the day, bodily fluids do come out. And out of honor to a woman, we don't want that her bodily fluids will come out while she's out of the grave. So we try to bury women as fast as possible. We minimize the amount of time that we will let the corpse sit, more so with women than with men. And Rachel, who died during childbirth, was bleeding profusely. She certainly had that issue that if they detain her burial, then it would be a disgrace to her body to start carrying her around to bury. Yeah, Jeff, I'm with you. Okay, so now Yitzchak passes away. Yaakov comes back to his father. He's with his father in Kiryas Arba, and Yitzchak passes away. He's buried by Esav and Yaakov. Esav takes the first stand. He doesn't give Yaakov the honor of going first. He feels like he's first. And Yaakov doesn't put up a fight. The parsha ends with a recording of Esav's wives and Esav's offsprings and Esav's the kings that were established in Edom before Moshe Rabbeinu came to the scene. Even though it says before there was a king in Israel, Moshe is called the king of Israel, the Yibishurun Melech. It's interesting to go through their lineage to see how much incest was going on. It's interesting to see how Esav would change their names to try and show that they were pious people. He would call his wife Yehudis, as though she believes in only one God, even though she's serving other gods. And this is classical for Esav, always trying to show the good face and hide who he really is. There's more to discuss, but yeah. Yeah, Binyamin was born. That's when Rivka passed away. Okay. Any questions still here? Okay. Yeah.
But to the end, Rachel was always Yaakov's favorite wife, yeah?
Yeah. In the end, Rachel was still Yaakov's favorite wife. It doesn't seem like it was something that Yaakov wanted. It seems like it was something that was intrinsic, which is something you have to know. In life, you don't always have control about how you feel. With your children, you will have children that you naturally are more inclined to like, and children that you're naturally more inclined to be upset at. And a parent has to balance that. That's what we will discuss next week, the favoritism that appears in Yaakov's treatment of his children. We'll see that. But even with his wife, it's unclear, at least to me, as to how overt this favoritism really was. Leah knew he wanted to marry Rachel. Leah knew that she forced herself upon Yaakov. And Leah knew that Yaakov loved Rachel better. She says that very clearly in naming her children. But Yaakov, being a good husband, I'm sure did his best not to make that so obvious. But Leah, being a wife, she knew what was really going on in her husband's mind. Women know what's going on within us, more so than we know what's going on within them. Yeah.
So, sorry, put a little extension on that. Something I noticed, and you probably noticed too, but
not necessarily. Yeah.
Yitzchak had two sons, Esav and Yaakov. His favorite Esau. So Yaakov is now a man. He has a favorite wife and a favorite son. And maybe he doesn't exactly show that he favors his wife, but he certainly shows that he favors his son, no?
That we have to discuss next week. If you want, we could discuss it now. Okay, but it's really next week's subject. The next week's parsha begins with that. The relationship between Yaakov and Yosef as opposed to the other children, which on the one hand our sages say he erred in. On the other hand, we do see he tried to cover it up. So we'll try to discuss that next week.
You mean 2 weeks from now?
Yeah. No, next week. Parshas Vayeshev. Next week's Parsha. Gotcha. Yeah.
I guess it's not really important for today, but do we learn something from this combination that he has four wives and had to deal with that? Why we don't do that today? Or is there anything...
As far as Yaakov having four wives, so it seems like that was the heavenly intent. it wasn't the accepted practice that a person should have many wives throughout most of the generations. Even in the Torah, it doesn't seem to be so common. We don't find Moshe having two wives, Aaron having two wives. it doesn't seem to be the most common practice, other than among kings. Kings, it seems, it was common, had more than one wife. The fact that Yaakov had four wives seems to have been the heavenly intent, and it seems that it was to an extent problematic, as we will see next week's parsha, as far as the children and how they felt towards one another. But to say that we will derive from there about whether we should have two wives or not doesn't seem that way. It's not recommended ever to have more than one wife. It's not recommended. You're bringing fights into the house the second you're bringing competition into the house. But this is we have a whole class on the concept of two wives, and if you want, we'll have another one.
There will be fights only if you have a favorite one.
No.
No.
I don't think so. Okay. Anything else about the parsha? Okay. So let's go over to Mishlei.